Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, I'm Dr. Robert Pearl, former CEO of the Permanente Medical Group, Kaiser Permanente, a Stanford Medical and Business School professor, a Forbes contributor and best-selling author of the book Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare and Why We're Usually Wrong.
And I am Jeremy Corr, host of the New Books in Medicine podcast. American healthcare is broken. Across the United States, there are over 200,000 patient deaths from medical error every year, growing physician burnout, outdated technology, and inconvenient and delayed care for patients. And on top of all of this, skyrocketing drug prices and increasingly unaffordable out-of-pocket patient expenses. For decades, our nation's political and medical leaders have talked about fixing the American healthcare system, and yet the problems are now greater than in the past.
Every other industry that is inefficient and ineffective has experienced disruption. Healthcare will be no different. The question is whether the solutions will come from inside the healthcare system or be imposed on it. We'd like to invite you to listen to our new podcast, Fixing Healthcare with Dr. Robert Pearl and Jeremy Corr. Each episode will feature one of the top leaders and innovative thinkers in healthcare today. The show's format is simple. The guests will present a roadmap for fixing American healthcare's biggest problems. And from there, Jeremy and I will scrutinize the plan and help listeners separate fixes that have the potential to succeed from simply the hype.
Our goal is that everyone from healthcare consumers to political and medical leaders will find value in the discussions on our show. You may not agree with the different solutions offered, but you will never again conclude that nothing can be done. We hope you will join us. Please subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast software. For more information, visit our website at www.fixinghealthcarepodcast.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books in Medicine podcast. I am your host, Jeremy Corr. Today, we will be talking with Dr. Henry J. Prisbillo. He is an associate professor of anesthesiology at Northwestern University School of Medicine and has performed anesthesia over 30,000 times throughout his career. He is here today to talk about his book, Counting Backwards, A Doctor's Notes in Anesthesia. This is a book I would highly recommend to anyone with even the slightest bit of curiosity about anesthesiology. Dr. Henry J. Prisbillo, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I appreciate your offer.
Dr. J., I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself, including how you ended up in anesthesiology.
Wonderful. When I was in high school, I decided medicine was a reality for me. And that's quite a statement coming from a truly blue-collar, nobody in white-collar, nobody in medicine. And so I decided to pursue medicine. And at the same time, I got married. And that led to a bit of a conundrum in that I was going to go surgery. But shortly after entering surgery, for a couple of reasons, of which my family was one of them, I already had two children, I moved into anesthesia. And it seemed to fit all the needs for both myself and the family. And so I became an anesthesiologist.
All right. Now, you mentioned a little bit of a Bruce Springsteen influence with your move into anesthesiology. Can you share that?
When I was in medical school, I took an elective in anesthesia. They actually paid some money. At that time, they were trying to recruit people into it. I'm not sure why, because it seemed like it was pre-filled. But I took the elective in med school and entered anesthesia, and promptly, I mean, with the intention of spending that money on speakers, took that check, ran out to the stereo store, got a couple of nice big giant kick butt speakers, and in addition, bought Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run. And boy, that apartment rumbled while I was playing with it. And insidiously, anesthesia kind of crept into my mind and my career.
So I got to ask you, I hate to ask you such a tough question this early on in the show, but what was it like to crank up the volume on those speakers and rock out to the new Bruce Springsteen album?
The only thing I had to worry about was how disturbing to the rest of the people in the apartment building I was. but you know, it really didn't make a heck of a lot of consideration to me, and I just let it fly.
That's awesome. Now, the name of the book, Counting Backwards, has a pretty clever meaning behind it. Can you explain that to our listeners?
Well, counting backwards is something that you do with adults. In children, I talk about something a little bit different in the smells that they're having, and that it smells like piggies at the zoo. But for adults, you just say conventionally counting backwards. It tends to go back to the 40s was the first place that I actually saw it mentioned. And it was at a time when the medications that we used to induce anesthesia was an IV barbiturate, and you went off to sleep pretty quickly. So it was my thought, and there isn't any articles or anything out there to speak of that talked about counting backwards during the 40s and 50s, and that's how it came to be. Subsequently, after I wrote the book, I actually found one of the readers sent me a reference to counting backwards, actually going back to the early 1900s, but it was in a little bit different context, and I'm not sure that it actually stayed at that particular point in time. So it's probably mentioned first in the 1900s, early 1900s, but it seems to have come in when barbiturates came for inducing anesthesia.
Out of curiosity, under your care, what's the furthest back anyone has been able to count?
Oh, you know, I mess with them. So I watch these people come in, and you know, I could see that they're already working at counting backwards and this and that. And as soon as I say, okay, I'm going to start counting backwards from 100, they start kind of, wait, we're going to do it by 70s, by sevens. And they never make it into the 80s, so that's just fine with me.
That's fascinating. It's funny, the last time I had surgery a few years ago, I actually remember trying to see how long I could stay awake after I was given the anesthesia drugs. And the last thing I remember was trying to stay awake as long as I could, and that my arm was starting to get a little cold from the IV fluid. So clearly I didn't do that good of a job.
You know, it's rule number one of anesthesia: I always win, that is yet to be disproven. So I can adjust it. I can put the medication in the IV before I even have people start counting. There's all kinds of things I can do. But the fact is, as soon as I say by sevens, they're so flummoxed, the patients never have an idea what to do. Children, on the other hand, it's a little more interesting because they go to sleep by mask. You know, we frequently don't have IVs. They're more afraid of needles than they are of the mask. And so they breathe through the mask and go off to sleep by the mask. And that's going to be a little bit longer, and that's where I tend to, you know, tell the piggy stories, because the gas smells different. Piggies are one thing, the zoo is one thing that most of the kids understand. So they get the piggies, and they get a few questions into piggies. You know, how many piggies do you smell? How big are they? What are their colors? And that's about it for them before they drift off to sleep.
Okay. In the book, you detail a bit about the history of anesthesia. Can you please tell us about its discovery, some of the milestones along the way, and some of the mysteries that still surround it to this day?
Wonderful. You know, the breathing gases was a late 1700s type thing. when scientists were starting able to differentiate the different gases. And one of the first ones that they differentiated in the anesthesia realm was nitrous oxide. And so in the late 1700s and in the early 1800s, laughing gas, nitrous oxide, was introduced, and it was introduced as a party drug. And laughing gas, I mean, that's the reason why. And people then decided that they could take it a little bit further, especially dentistry. Dentistry was a big procedure back then when they were pulling rotten teeth and trying to do so comfortably. And so they were trying to do it with laughing gas, and it wasn't being so successful. But within that same period of time, the ethers, the gases from the ethers were introduced and were also found to have a party use. And in the South, southern U.S., they were doing it to the slaves so that there would be parties with all the whatever, and they would bring a slave in and they would make them breathe the ether and while having them dance and watching them stumble around. And for some reason, that seemed to be enjoyment. And then it was determined that, hey, you know, if laughing gas isn't quite strong enough, but ether, you know, look at the bumps these people are getting and the cuts they're getting and not remembering them, maybe this is a better gas. And so ether was introduced first by a surgeon physician in the South, Crawford Long, but there were all kinds of superstitions and possible religious things that were going on in that he billed for it. And that's why we know Crawford Long actually used ether in the early 1840s, but it wasn't until the ether dome in the later 40s when it was actually proposed as an anesthetic agent, although anesthesia was a term coined after the introduction of it.
Okay. Now, can you please describe in your book what you call your anesthesia command center and walk us through everything that happens from when a patient enters your care to when a patient leaves your care?
Okay, that's a great, very broad question. The command center is most people think about it, the operating room. I tend to try and bring it off as a procedure room, since procedures, not operations, are being performed more commonly today, procedures being endoscopies and cardiac procedures and different intravascular procedures. So it's being produced, being done throughout operating rooms, hospitals, outpatient surgery centers, etc. So we go into a procedure room, and in that procedure room is the area where the anesthesiologist and all the equipment is set up. And so that's my command center. So what I try to describe is that if you're thinking of the room as a watch, the floor being the watch face around it. If you're looking straight forward, you're looking directly at the patient and the patient's head, which is right in front of me. And if you start using that as sort of the noontime, and you start moving around to the right, going clockwise, you're now coming out to the various different pieces of equipment that I'm using. And just jump in, please, if you want to stop it or you want any more recognition. But you come to the gases that are coming out of the machine through the tubes to the patient. Then you come to the anesthetic machine, which is a behemoth. I mean, this thing is hundreds of pounds with all the weight in it. It has all the gases, but it also has the monitors on top of it. So that is truly the main command center, is the anesthesia machine. And so I can dial in the amount of gases that are being used, both the oxygen and breathing gases in addition to the anesthetic gases. And then I can measure all of that in addition to all the vital signs that I want to measure, which include heart rate, blood pressure, temperature, etc. As you continue to turn clockwise and around, now you're reaching towards the back and you're at the 6 o'clock position, and that's a anesthesia cabinet that contains all the equipment that isn't being used immediately. All the things that are being used immediately are placed on top of the anesthesia machine, all the things that you think you might need are in that anesthesia cart or on top of that anesthesia cart. You keep turning around, and now you're at the 1, 2, 3 o'clock positions, and that's where you're going to have the variety of IVs, IV poles, and all the things that are going to be given through the intravenous region. Reasons. And you're going to have drugs that you're going to be pushing through those draw lines, et cetera. And now you continue to come around and you're back at 6 o'clock and you're back facing your patient. So I try to stay with my self, my face to the patient and watching the patient, and then I can gauge to the right and see the anesthesia machine and all the monitors, and to the left is the IVs.
Would you mind telling me a little bit about what you call in your book your oh shit shelf?
I placed that so cautiously, didn't I? there's one drug that is the kick butt drug of all that I have, and that's epinephrine. Epinephrine it's amazing the amount of things that it does for the body. It increases the heart rate, increases the blood pressure. It is really the get out of trouble drug. That drug is always put on the oh shit shelf, which is above the anesthesia section. And it's right at where the monitor starts. So it's about shoulder height to the 3 o'clock position on that clock. And it's called the oh shit shelf because if anybody in the room says oh shit, my hand is going to that shelf. So that's what it really comes down to. And I caution everybody not to say oh shit unless they really mean it. But the first thing I'm grabbing for is what's the emergency drug that's going to get the best response for the patient to get the vital signs stable, et cetera, and that's going to be epinephrine.
Do the other people in the room typically know about the existence of that shelf?
I make sure everybody in the room knows about that shelf, and I hope that they all understand. I never want to reach for that shelf, and I also try to tell them, this is what's going to make me reach for that shelf. And, you know, and some people are cautious and they'll never say that word. Others are not so cautious and they'll say that word. And they watch my hand reach up for that. They say, no. Or, yeah, it's time. It's time.
Right.
So they give me a clue.
All right. Let's go back to that a little bit about the summary between or about what, you know, what happens when a patient kind of enters your care through the process of when they end up leaving your care.
Okay. You know, we head back to before we hit the operating room or the procedure room at all. And I'm first meeting these patients, usually in the pre-anesthesia area. I would love to meet them before then, but that's the way our system works. So before they come back to the procedure room, I go and meet them and I introduce myself and I do a history and physical and get all these things done. And it's about 3 minutes. And when you think about it, that 3 minutes is probably the most important 3 minutes of life when it comes right down to it. And in that 3 minutes, I have to both learn everything I can about the patient from history, from physical exam, but also try to introduce a relationship, develop a relationship so that the patient can trust me and the family and whoever else is around develops a certain level of trust. Because I believe that's very, very important, and it relieves the anxiety of the people who are unfortunately not getting any medications, and that's the family who are waiting in the waiting room while the patient is fast asleep and I'm doing everything I can to worry about the patient myself. So that's about 3 minutes. And after about 3 minutes, checking the chart, making sure all the notes are entered, we head back to the procedure room. And in the procedure room, things that are going to happen is after the patient's identified, making sure everything's all right, I'm putting on my monitors. And monitors are those things which I'm going to measure as they're drifting asleep and throughout the entire anesthetic, and understand anesthesia really isn't sleep, but we can talk about that a little bit later. It's a far different state. But I'm putting on monitors to measure the heart rate, the heart's electrical activity, the blood pressure, watching the breathing, temperature, and those are all going to come up on the screen to my right And there's also some audible aspects to them. So I can hear the heart rate and I can hear the tone of how much oxygen is being delivered and received by the body. But my eyes are pretty much straightforward, trying to guess what those numbers are by looking at the patient. And then every once in a while confirming what the numbers are on the screen. So once the patient is in the procedure room and all the monitors are placed and everything's identified, then we're ready to start the anesthetic procedure. And so for the older patient who's going to have an IV, it's going to be very, very quick, and that's what counting backwards comes in, because it's going to be the medications introduced through the IV, and those are very, very quick. And that's how I can be sure that patients are never getting out of the 90s, especially if they're counting backwards by 7. And then the children are breathing the gas, and then the gas is with the piggy stories, and off to sleep they go. Once they're anesthetized, now I have a couple of functions that I'm responsible for. And first of all, it's for all the vital signs of the patient, making sure the patient is perfectly stable, that the patient is perfectly comfortable, and I'm watching everything that's happening in that room, especially the patient and whoever's performing the procedure and what they're doing. So making sure that all goes smoothly and keeping vital signs stable, et cetera. And then we reach the end of the procedure, and then I'm turning off my gases, reversing all my medications, and waking the patient up, again, all while constantly monitoring and making sure that the patient is stable. Now, let me tell you, that's a little bit easier said than done, because during a procedure, there are times when there's very little being done to the patient, and you have to be careful that you're not giving too much medication and impacting the vital signs too much. And on the other hand, there's times when there's a lot of stimulation going on, and so you want to make sure that the patient's adequately comfortable during that period. So it's not always a constant level of anesthesia that you're giving. It's a constant level necessary to perform the procedure at the safest possible state and the most comfortable state for the patient. So that's what's going on during that period of time.
Okay. So the term anesthesia means without feeling, but that does not encompass all of the goals of your care. Can you explain what you call in your book the 5 A's?
Okay. Anesthesia was a term coined shortly after the use of gas to provide a senseless patient, if you will. And so anesthesia meant without feeling, and it was exact for that particular point in time. And the stability of the vital signs and the various factors that impacted them wasn't well known. Subsequent to that, we started dissecting out what we needed to know. And so we came up with the 5 A's. Now, searching for the 5 A's in history is similar to searching for counting backwards and all the other parts of anesthesia, and it's just not well documented. But I presented the 5 A's trying to replace the term anesthesia with different A's that impacted. And they include everything from anxiety, which is primarily an issue before the case, to amnesia, not remembering anything, analgesia, pain, areflexia, which is has to do with vital signs and keeping everything stable, akinesia, meaning not moving. And they all use different medications if given separately. The gas is a beautiful thing. That gas covers everything. Covers all of those. It reduces every, the anxiety. It controls the heart rate, blood pressure. You can prevent movement if you're deep enough. It does everything beautifully. But there's times when the gas is impossible or it isn't wise to use. And so we flip back to those 5 A's and then give the medications for each of those that reaches the point of safety and comfort for the patients.
Okay, perfect.
I hope that answers it appropriately for you.
No, absolutely, absolutely. As an anesthesiologist...
If it doesn't, just ask, yeah. Please.
No, it's great. As an anesthesiologist, your knowledge must span all other specialties. Will you go into a bit of detail about how what you would do would be different for one procedure versus another?
let's drop back a little bit first, and I will pose to you and to your listeners that anesthesia is possibly the one specialty in all of medicine that allows the least to be forgotten from medical school. One thing that we don't delve into deeply is the actual pathology, meaning looking at the cells to figure out what's wrong and what's going to happen. But in terms of that, you know, every step from all your basic sciences, pathology, anatomy, physiology is involved with anesthesia, as are all the other things, basic sciences associated with it. From anatomy, physiology, pharmacology, pediatrics, internal medicine, surgery. You take virtually every part of medical school is involved in an anesthesiologist's care and the need to know, which is quite important. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a very, very significant thing about anesthesia. In terms of the specifics about what's happening, let's talk about a 20-year-old who went down a ski mountain and hit a rock and has torn a knee ligament. Mm-hmm. That's one of the easier ones because they're usually fairly healthy outside of it. So you don't have to worry as much about internal medicine about that. But you want to know about, you know, you have a knee injury. Now, what do you need to anesthetize? What are those 5 A's is actually necessary? Mm-hmm. What I'm most concerned about, most is a little bit of an overstatement, but I am very concerned about the patient's comfort after the procedure. Mm-hmm. Anesthesia in itself is usually during the procedure itself, and you put the gas on, the patient goes under anesthesia, you do your procedure, you turn the gas off, and the patient's now out from anesthesia. But there's a whole lot of discomfort that needs to be considered, and via stable vital signs. So the discomfort we can talk about in terms of regional anesthesia, blocking nerves, blocking the spine, and not needing as deep of an anesthetic, gas anesthetic. The patient doesn't have to be so deep that their vital signs are a concern. And sometimes even memory isn't a big issue. The patient doesn't want memory loss. They want to be awake during the procedure. And so you're giving pain relief. You're giving stability to vital signs. You're making sure they're not moving while they're still understanding. So you break those 5 A's down into what you need. And on this 20-year-old for a knee procedure, it can become very, very interesting, intriguing on what you do and how you reach it. On the other hand, you have a 65, 70-year-old with a heart attack coming in and needing some cardiac procedure, and you're eliminating the ability to be awake, and you're just having them go off to sleep, and so that they're amnestic, they're not remembering anything, they're not anxious. But now you have to worry about how deep you're getting them in terms of the heart working, because the heart's malfunctioning. And so each patient presents a different quandary, and you're going to adjust those 5 A's to the specific case and hopefully continue the pain relief as necessary after the procedure.
Okay. You say that in your anesthesiologist dreams, you dream of railroad tracks. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah. We're recording vital signs the entire time. And if you think about railroad tracks that are straight and narrow and going right down from where you are off to the horizon, if you think of that being an anesthetic record, it's a piece of paper. It's recording all these vital signs. Instead of them jumping up and down and curving all over the place, you want them nice and parallel and straight across that page. And so those are kind of like railroad tracks running across your page, but you don't want the curves. You want them nice and straight so that the heart rate, the blood pressures, the breathing, the oxygenation, everything stays nice and stable across. So it looks like a railroad track going straight across the anesthesia record. It's a nice, stable patient.
What was your most difficult case?
Oh, God. There's, you know, There's so many of them. And every time a person asks me this, I'm probably thinking of a different case. One of the cases that I think about is actually a case that was done in interventional radiology. And it was a patient who was thought to have a hepatic liver problem and was possibly bleeding because blood was backing up in the liver and not flowing well through it. And then all the problems associated with a liver that's not functioning, which includes the clotting mechanisms of the blood and not functioning right. And as we're doing the case, the blood was just flying out of the patient's mouth and it was coming from the stomach. And we realized that his major problem was bleed that was on the surface of the stomach. And so it was a god-awful case when you think about it. And it fortunately turned out well. But it was a lot. And not only was I charged with trying to keep the patient stable, I had the problem with the blood coming out of the mouth and what I was going to do to try and stop that. Or at least get it out of my way so I could breathe adequately for the patient and not have this mess going on. And it took multiple hands. I had substantial help pushing the blood, pushing the drugs, making sure the IVs were all fine in addition to emptying out the stomach. And meanwhile, trying to keep them as stable as I could. And by the grace of God, he did quite well and survived. And is still alive today.
That's great.
Your specialty is pediatric anesthesiology. You share a lot of stories in the book where your warmth and compassion can really be felt, even in the face of some of the difficulties that come along with that pediatric specialty. You mentioned that pre-procedure fear and anxiety is something that is very common from both the child patients and their parents. Can you share a story or two about how you manage that?
Oh, boy, I could share hours and hours about all the different people that I've cared for, all the patients, all the parents I've cared for. One of the stories, and this is a very interesting thing, in that when I have these interviews, when people have talked to me about the book, when they've mentioned it, they interestingly never mention the last chapter of the book, the chapter about this boy that I was taking care of, and I had taken care of numerous times, and for the grace of God or whatever, these patients, the parents just kept asking me. It was actually the father that always called me and say, "Oh, Nick's coming back. Nick's coming back. Can you help us out? Can you help us out?" And Nick had a variety of issues, trying to make the parents as comfortable as possible was a major undertaking. You know, within minutes of leaving the parents, I have Nick asleep. And so he's nice and comfortable and I can take care of him and this and that. The issue came into one of the ways that I thought I could alleviate the parents' anxiety was with the St. Christopher's medal.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw Nick, and this was numerous times, numerous procedures into his care. But this was a big procedure. It was a cardiac procedure. He was having a redo cardiac procedure. And I saw Nick in the pre-op area with his parents, and his medal flashed. And it was probably the way I walked in and the reflection out of the windows, whatever. But I saw the St. Christopher's medal flash. And so I just assumed, maybe that's a wrong term, because you know what assume means, making an ass of you and me. So I assumed that medal was of importance. And I virtually insisted, "Hey, you know, that medal's come back with Nick and this and that, hoping to give the parents something to relax about," and then promptly lost the medal. And, oh, God, I went home. I was just absolutely distraught, you know, telling my wife I lost God and this and that, and I couldn't believe it. And I tore through bags in the sterile, non-sterile area, and I was going through everything, and I wasn't able to find these things. And I felt like, you know, a nitwit for having lost that medal, and it was so important, and this and that. And they're calling me from the unit, and I'm thinking, oh, geez. And so, you know, I went, and after having an uber successful case, surgeon did a wonderful job, and Nick was doing just fine. And they say, can you tell me where the medal is? And I'm, oh, geez. And so I had to confess that I lost the medal, and still they requested me the time after. And I was between baffled, you know, you still trust me, and grateful. You still trust me. And fortunately, they called me the day before and saying, you know, Nick's coming in. Can you take care of him? And it allowed me to find a medal. And when Nick returned to the recovery area, and I got that similar phone call, Dr. J, can you please come to the unit and see Nick? And this time they're holding the medal, and they say, where did this come from? And my only response was, God works in mysterious ways. So I'll go whatever distance it can take me, mm-hmm. to make sure that the people in the waiting area, the people that are standing behind, you know, hopefully waiting for everything to work out, are as comfortable as they could possibly be. But the prime person is, of course, the patient.
Right, right. Now, again, in talking about those the difficulties around pediatric anesthesiology, do you mind sharing the Captain Crunch story?
I have this little boy, 3-4 years old, coming down for an abdominal procedure. He had problems with his intestines, and the surgeon wanted to take a look at him, but needed anesthesia to keep him comfortable. And I walk it to him in the pre-op holding area, and he's alone. Whoever brought him dropped him off and ran. There was no nurse. Parents weren't around. He was alone. And he's 3-4 years old, and he's sitting on this bed in this rather dark room. And I walk in. Before I can introduce myself and, you know, describe what's going to happen, he says, I have Captain Crunch. And then shuts up. And it's the only thing he says to me. And then he looks at me, and I can see his white teeth. And I'm thinking, oh, no. And so I start looking high and low. And the reason being, if you have something in the stomach, if you eat not long before anesthesia, acid's produced, and now the anesthesia is going to relax the muscles in the body. And in terms of the stomach, it's going to relax the muscle that as it enters the stomach from the esophagus, from the tube going from the mouth to the stomach, it's going to, both ends, it's going to relax. And it's also going to prevent the vocal cords from closing if there's any stimulation for anything being in the mouth. You occasionally feel that with something going down the wrong pipe and your vocal cords close and you can't speak and this and that. So that's what I'm worried about. And he just says, I have Captain Crunch, and clams up.
Oh my
gosh. Now I'm searching for all over the place. How am I going to find out if he had anything to eat or not? And there's no parent, there's no nurse, there's no transporter. So I call up to the unit, and I'm speaking to the nurse and asking about did he have Captain Crunch or not? And she said, absolutely not, doctor, absolutely not. And so I go back to him, and they say, no, they said you didn't have any. We're good to go in this and that. And then once again, it blurts out, I have Captain Crunch, and not another word. And I go, oh, geez, why is this happening to me? Now, I could have been, you know, the easy thing would have been just to say, go back up to your room, let's reschedule this. But I'm thinking, you know, he's got a problem, and, you know, nobody's around him, and how can he be doing this? And so I keep searching. And the nurse is getting more and more angry with him. And finally, after speaking to her the third time, I think it was, she says, he absolutely did not have Captain Crunch. We go back to the operating room and induce the anesthesia. And there comes the Captain Crunch out of his mouth. And so I quickly turn him over, and I'm suctioning out. And, you know, I'm thinking, oh, Lord, if this Captain Crunch gets down the trachea, it can cause a burn, a chemical burn, because it's acid in the stomach. So it isn't so much the Captain Crunch. I'm worried about what's associated with the Captain Crunch, what happens in response to the Captain Crunch being in the stomach. I'm thinking all this acid, and I'm sweating bullets in the operating room, mm-hmm. as I'm suctioning out his mouth and trying to get him to breathe in that. And there, but for the grace, went I. He had Captain Crunch, but he didn't aspirate. but that's then led into the discussion in the book about why you want NPO, nothing per os. You don't want to be eating or drinking anything before a procedure, and the reasons why and what to do. So he taught me a lot, and that stuck around for a long, long time with me. I remember him for a long time, for a long time to come.
Did you ever figure out where he got the Captain Crunch from?
He said he got it from his, after everything was all set and done, and he's in recovery room, and now we're investigating. He told me he got it off a bedmate's tray. So, how many ways can you get screwed? Infinite. Right. Always remember that. I had a surgeon in medical school that had that on a little postcard. How many ways can you get screwed? And then the opposite, he'd flip it over, and the opposite was the infinite sign, the two circles joined. So, and that's all I could think of. So, oh, geez, how many ways? Infinite, right. Of course.
Now, in the book, you state that you've worked with a wide variety of patients, everything from the smallest of micro preemies to morbidly obese teenagers. There was one patient you had, however, that wasn't even human. Would you mind sharing that story with us?
Talking about Tabibu, it was a holiday weekend. And for whatever reason, when I left on the Friday, my name was not on the schedule for the following Tuesday. And so the weekend went fine. I don't remember being anything specific. It was a Memorial Day. And I'm strolling into the hospital on the Tuesday morning. It's very early. I'm always there, 6:30 at the latest. And as I'm strolling in, the surgical fellow is grabbing me saying, I need help. I need help. And so I check and I have no cases and I follow him and we lead out of the building and I'm thinking, okay, now where are we going to? And we lead into a research building. I think, okay, he's got some cells that he's studying and he needs some help with a research protocol, this and that. We're walking up the stairs to the research center and we will approach a door, which was the research center operating room, and it's open and I'm stopped in the doorway, because there on the operating room table is a gorilla, a baby gorilla, laying on the table, and I'm thinking, oh my God, what now? And so it's between the thought of, here's this most incredible animal that you can never ever get close to, and the animal, and soon to find out a young female little girl gorilla is having some real issues, and so you jump out of that mode. For, oh my God, I got a great ape and a gorilla I'm taking care of, to gotta get this done, gotta get this done, gotta get this done. And she was in deep doo-doo. It turned out she had a bowel procedure done at the beginning of the weekend by a partner of mine. And they had found that she had an infection that had eaten a hole in her intestines and had closed that up. But they listened to the zoo vet. And if you think about a zoo vet, it's the family practitioner of medicine. They care for wide variety of things, except in their case, a wide variety of different animal species, in addition to all the issues that go on. And so instead of thinking about this one particular animal, they were thinking about the wide variety and say, okay, yes, you're right, this animal should go back to the zoo. And not understanding that this animal couldn't eat or drink. And now it's a couple days later, and this animal's in deep shock from not being able to have anything to eat or drink and no IV because she's being a little rambunctious. And now she's nearing the end of life. So it was a shocking time. But again, you have to kick into caring first.
Right.
And then all the compassion and everything after. So dropped right into my, let's care for this animal, my patient, and let's make sure that this animal's as stable as can be, and starting an IV, developing an airway, and getting her as stable as can be, controlling everything as possible. and meaning breathing for her, watching her heart rate, giving her medications to support her heart rate, giving her medications and fluids to improve her status. And it was a hairy few days. In the meantime, as we're caring for her, the zoo vet comes up to us a day or so later and says, you know, it's time to call it. And the fellow and I, it was absolutely in unison. I remember it so vividly that we just spoke like we were one voice, but they were coming out of two different people and saying, you know, sorry, you had your chance. Now she's ours. We'll get her back to you when we feel she's stable, but you're out of the decision loop. And with that, the zoo vet actually kind of melted and understood that you know, care was no longer her issue, and cost, we would worry about that later. But right now, we're only issued about the health of the great ape and Tabibu. And so we took as best a care possible, and it took about 4 days, 3 to 4 days, and Tabibu woke up. So we did something right and corrected everything we could. And when she woke up, she was full of vigor at this point. But we kept her in the research center for an extra day or two just to make sure she was doing fine. And we moved her off the operating table, pulled out the endotracheal tube that was doing the breathing for her, and then took off the IVs that she had, and set her into a room that had some nice covers, but not a whole lot else, so that she couldn't get into any trouble, and fed her, and she started to feed. More importantly, she started to drink, right. and we sent her back to the zoo. What's most important about this, or most interesting about this, is that you know, a month or two later, the zoo had a party for all the people that were involved in Tabibu's care, and so my whole family went down to the zoo, and you know, they were all excited, this and that. But Tabibu was in her great ape habitat, and everything was happening outside, and they had the polar bear keepers. And they were feeding the polar bears, and it was a wonderful time for everybody. And I just grabbed one of the zookeepers, and I said, I got to go see Tabibu. And so we slipped into the back of the building, and Tabibu was in her cage, in her setting. But it was just, we were just a couple feet away through a window, and I was watching Tabibu eat, and it was just a very special moment for me. And that was the last time I got to see Tabibu, because she actually then was sent off to another zoo in some animal exchange. And she wound up in Columbus. And I knew she was in Columbus, but, you know, kind of time goes by. And right. And after I wrote the chapter for the book, I looked her up again. And lo and behold, Tabibu not only went to this other zoo, but she thrives at the other zoo. And I thought she was sterile. I thought she could not get pregnant. I thought the procedure had taken that away from her. Lo and behold, Tabibu had a little baby, a little great ape, a little boy. And they named the boy JJ. And I thought, oh, this is so magnificent. You know, not only does she have a little boy, she's alive, she's thriving, but they named the boy after me. Of course, they didn't understand that. They have no idea who I am. But there's a little JJ great ape in the Columbus Zoo who's the offspring of Tabibu. And I'm proud to say that, at least in part, it's due to the care that I gave.
That's such an amazing story. I'm going to have to definitely look up photos of her online and her little baby.
Yes. Yeah, I would recommend that highly.
In the book, it is very clear that you are a confident perfectionist and one that is very self-aware and hard on yourself when you make what you have perceived to be an error. There was one time, though, where you felt that you had made a major error with a patient, but the patient's mother credits you with saving her daughter's life. Can you please share that story with us?
Yeah, yes. This, you know, this. I had a phone call. Well, I don't remember if I was on call that night or if the person at the front desk just recognized I was around and shuffled the call off to me or whatever. But I got a call about a child who had a respiratory tract infection or thought to have a respiratory tract infection, and what should be done. And so my policy has always been that if you can optimize the patient before you give them an anesthetic, you have the best chances of having an outcome, the least amount of complications as a result of that. And so I looked up the child and I said, okay, this is what the story is. Let's hold for 2 weeks. And if they're not better in 2 weeks, bring them in. I'll evaluate. I reserve the right to cancel the case if I think it's in the best. However, bring the patient in and let me see them directly. And the 2 weeks go by, and I dropped that patient. I mean, the patient just went out of my mind as I was caring for other patients. And so the patient shows up, and I listen, and I'm not connecting the original phone call to this, mm-hmm. But I'm told the patient may have had a cold and this and that, and I take a look at the patient, but I let my resident do the physical exam. And so I'm just looking at the patient and say, okay, you know, it's time to get this done. And the patient was having a combination of procedures done, and while we're doing the procedures, the oxygen level keeps dropping on the patient, and I'm not initially connecting it to the phone call and everything that's going on. And I'm thinking, oh geez, what did we get into here? And so I stabilized the patient as best as possible. And then, I order an x-ray and take the patient to the recovery area, and I meet the mother, and I say, here's the story. And the mother just almost bursts into tears as she's talking to me, and it's finally somebody's listening. And I'm thinking to myself, this is a conundrum. Because if I would have listened to begin with, and I mean listening to the patient's lungs myself, the case probably would have been canceled, would have been sent back to the pediatrician who has been dealing with this and just putting off the mother, putting off the father. Mm-hmm. And here it was, that I'm in this truly critical situation with a blunder of my own that I probably would not have done the case. And yet now the patient's here, and now the responsibility is mine. And now I'm going to do whatever I can to make the best out of this. And so the anesthetic went okay, but the oxygen levels are jumping all over the place. Not to critical levels, but they're jumping over, and it's wrong. And so get the chest x-ray. And when I looked at the chest x-ray, my heart just sank because it wasn't a pneumonia. She had I think it was a leukemia, although I thought at the time it was a lymphoma. And wound up in the intensive care unit after that as a result. As a result of that, though, jumped into immediate high-risk, high-intensity care. Mm-hmm. And received all the medications necessary to survive. And now we're talking a year and a half later, when I'm in an area talking to another colleague, and patients and parents and family and that are passing by. And this one woman is just staring at me a little bit and finally comes up and says to her daughter, "This is the man who saved the life." And it's just like, oh my God, all this is raining down on me, and save the life is a good thing. Although, you know, I wish I would have done it in a little bit more politically correct way,
right,
that didn't risk an anesthetic and a surgery for me to diagnose the fact that there's a major issue. The leukemia was taken care of and cured. And you know, how satisfied can you feel? How much happier can you feel? And yet you still have that guilt, mm-hmm. of knowing that the patient should have never gone to the operating room to begin with. So you know, it's one of those back and forth.
Right.
And I don't know, I'll never be able to satisfy myself on it. But she's alive, and that's what counts.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Now, you're a professor at a teaching hospital. One of the themes you kind of talk about in the book is, you know, those calls that you get from people who say, I want you to perform the anesthesia on my son's surgery or my daughter's surgery instead of the resident. What do you say to that?
That's referring back to a case that a mother calls me up, and it's during the day, and it's during cases, and in the hallway I answer. And we're going on about this, and it turns out she was an anesthetist at another hospital, and she had a child who needed a procedure, but the procedure was specific enough that our institution offered it. None of the other institutions in the area offered it. And I said, okay, I would love to. And she ends the discussion saying, or tries to end the discussion saying, you know, I only want you to touch my child. And, I had to stop it right there and say that it's a process. In the process, I'd like to think that I'm the most important person in the process, and perhaps I am, but it's a process that has multiple people, all of which are necessities to the process.
Right.
And that once you start trying to break the process, is when you start getting into potential errors. And I insisted that, you know, allow me to provide the care to the best of my ability. Don't ask me to do anything special. Don't ask me to do anything outside of the usual. Let me do it. I will deliver your child the best care possible, deliver your child in the best condition possible back to you, but let me do it my way. And interestingly enough, after she thought about it for a while, she said, okay. And it was obvious she wasn't happy the day that I took care of her child. But it was obvious that she was happy afterwards, right, because a number of months later, I get a return phone call from her asking her if I would care for her son. So I care for both her daughter and her son. And I obviously made an impression upon her.
And you
can't break a system. You know, you can try and get the best people that you think are available for that system. But don't change the system. Don't break the system. Mm-hmm. Keep it the way it is and let people do their best to the best of their ability. And that was a big issue there. And I still, I mean, that's the way life is. You know, I love to take care of all patients, but it's got to be done in the way that I feel is the most appropriate without altering the system.
Right, right. Well, your book is full of fascinating personal stories like that and others. I have taken up a lot of your time today, Dr. J. My final question for you is, what are you working on now?
Oh, you know, I actually have 3 books in the process right now. And the first is the obvious one, that this book is receiving enough attention that maybe it needs a little bit more consideration. And so a couple of the cases that were dropped out of the first book by the agent and by the publisher, may be important enough to discuss in a second book, in addition to discussing a little bit more about the 3 minutes and a few other aspects of healthcare and anesthesia care as they pertain to what's happening today. So, tentatively, I'm calling it Still Counting, so that's in the process. Unfortunately, if you read Counting Backwards, there's a dedication in there, and that was to my wife. She passed away from a brain aneurysm, and so when I started writing, it was to give me something to do with her while also getting great relief, since I wasn't able to get relief through my own profession. The one way that I did get it was through writing. And so I went to receive my master's degree writing about my wife, and they're the ones who told me, put it down, you can't write through tears, and they were absolutely right, and led me on to Counting Backwards, which came out a whole lot easier for me to do, and I appreciate everybody's comments about the quality of the writing. So writing about my wife is the next thing, and then the last thing I was doing with my wife before she passed away was I was writing a novel. And my wife was deeply into the novel, reviewing the novel. And so that's the third one. And that's probably going to be the first one that's going to come up. Hopefully a publisher will agree that it's a quality work and publish it. So the novel's called Gem. And it's about a caregiver and pain relief and a girl with a cancer. The other one, my wife with the aneurysm and all the impacts that it had on my life. and then a follow-up to Counting Backwards, tentatively titled Still Counting.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. J, I've gotten
that's enough, isn't it?
Well, I tell you what, I've gotten to be a big fan of your work, and when you're finished with any of those books, you'll have to let me know. I can't wait to read them, and I hope you'll come back on the show to talk about those as well.
I'm truly appreciative of your thoughts and of your desire to continue to read work by me, and I would be most happy to come back to your show.
Fantastic, fantastic. I want to thank you again for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it, and it was a pleasure to talk to you. Take care.
Thank you for inviting me.